And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Today, we take a closer look at the news coming from around the world about what is happening on this great little planet Earth. We indulge ourselves in a reading for one of the new writers, and then we get into the hot seat and more when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, it's official. 2007 is happening. Now, maybe just me, although I'm the guy who's always talking about what I'm thinking and feeling, it's what I do for a living, but something definitely feels different. I'm now older than many and younger than some, which is to say that I've been tracking on this thing called life for a while. As a matter of record, I was here in the 50s when Disney launched his first television show, I think it was Walt Disney Presents, which morphed into the wonderful world of Disney. I mention that to say that I grew up in a time of relative innocence, which I'm sure many would be happy to call ignorance, and to a large extent, that's probably what it was. The world seemed endless then. There were brave people heading off into the jungles of South America and discovering primitive tribes which had never seen white people, as we were generally accepted to be then. Antarctica was a remote and frightening place of unbelievable cold and harshness, and when planes became lost in Wyoming or Alaska, it could take many days to find them. Men then still cut trees down in the vast forests with chainsaws, and the sound of crashing trees in the forest seemed to have significance. Felled trees, in some parts, were still floated to the mills and the rivers. But as I look at things then, the beginning of the modern era really began in about 1960. I'm one of four kids in my family. I have an older brother and a younger brother. We'd all been born by 1952. When I look back at photo albums of our family during the 50s, all the photos are in black and white. Now my sister came along in 1960. Almost all of the photos of her are in color. And such began the emergence of the modern era, when virtually all things began to become slicker, sleeker, cooler, noisier, bigger, faster, more managed, more controlled, more organized. It was about that time that the digital revolution was introduced, originally with punch cards and floors full of punch card operators. And the modern age exploded in a kind of contained nuclear explosion. And some wise souls then managed to see the handwriting on the forests and remote places, literally, and the environmental movement began in an effort to contain that explosion because, uncontrolled, such events could have global consequences. I've often felt that America follows a maturation process just like a living being, which in the case of America feels much more like a young male than a female. And as with any maturing male, we went through our youthful phase where we knew more than everyone else. We were cocksure of what we could do, and we just went ahead and did it, despite some of the warnings from our elders, like those old world leaders from Europe, who had a bit more experience in these things. We have the legacy of Vietnam to show for it, and amazingly, unlike most maturing beings who learn to temper their enthusiasm and bravado as they grow older, perhaps because we have been following along with a president who carried a bit too much of that Texas concept of bigger, better, meaner, and never to be outdone, we find ourselves reliving the same mistake, this time in Iraq. So what's all this have to do with today's show? Well, I get the sense that something is different, as I said, that we as a nation are maturing, that is, realizing our limitations, acknowledging that we are, after all, becoming one of those older nations, having made a few mistakes along the way. Maybe slowing down just a bit, willing to talk more, become a bit more diplomatic, and get to work taking care of ourselves more and trying to change the world a lot less. But here's the rub. In 2007, we're also beginning to hear a lot of stories coming from all around the world that we, as a world of people, have blustered our way into a tough situation. We've taken all these modern, emerging technologies and applied them in ever greater and powerful forms of digging, pushing, ripping, tearing, bulldozing, exploding, leveling, developing, and transforming the world to the point that we've just plain gone too far. And so during the first segment, I'm going to be reading a series of news reports from around the world about what is happening to the diversity of life on planet Earth. And I don't want to scare people. But because we're beginning to move into our maturing years, we need to acknowledge what we've done that will be affecting our years ahead. What should have been our golden age is beginning to look fairly bleak, at least in some respects. Not hopeless or destined to ruin, but becoming limited. And maybe the acceptance of those limitations is a sign of real maturity. And because I sense we're more willing to face the truth about our future, coming up are some of the details. Now in segment two, we switch medium just a bit. The Wild Side News features the voices of the Earth. We've talked with over 250 great people over the years, but there's another kind of voice. Anyone who writes, and certainly all of us who find the time to read, realize the different ways in which the written word is crafted and perceived. So in segment two, I'm going to read a segment from a book, as I hope to do more of in the months ahead. I'll be reading a portion from a book called All My Relations by Susan Chernek McElroy. And then living in San Diego here, I'm following the football playoffs quite carefully because the San Diego Chargers are considered one of the top teams. And so as these playoffs continue in earnest, and some of you will actually be attending games, I'm going to start out segment three with a great new idea for enjoying sitting on those cold benches, but as well those cold fishing boats or outdoors on a chilly evening. And from there, we take a look at a few other great outdoor products that will make your outdoor experiences even more terrific. So with an expanded version of the news, we offer some thoughts about our future, as told in the stories coming from around our planet. So now, the news. Story 1. Global warming will continue to make news in 2007, as it did recently when the National Climatic Data Center reported that last year was the warmest on record in the continental U.S. It attributed this to a continuation of the natural El Niño cycle and to the warming effects associated with greenhouse gases, which have been increasing due to humanity's presence on Earth. Now, of course, most of us all agree, yep, that's the way it is. 2006's average temperature was 55 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 2.2 degrees above the average for the last 100 years. As well, the last 9 years have all been among the 25 warmest years on record. And 2006 is expected to end up in either third or fourth warmest on record. Now, some Wild Side News projections for Story 1. Yes, global warming will continue. However, as the general changes will tend to be gradual through time, industrial societies will literally migrate to higher ground and accommodate to changing food availability through dietary change. In many cases, people will welcome a warming trend. Certainly, those who live in Southern California are not considered suffering as a result of a balmy and warmer climate than, say, Chicago. In various underdeveloped areas around the world, coastal populations will also pick up and move, which in many cases is easier to do than in more heavily industrialized civilizations. Desertification, which is a hard word to say, and which seems to be increasing in some areas, particularly in China, will continue, but may be offset by general increases in productivity as growing seasons increase. Certain species will be impacted. Most significantly is the polar bear, which has developed seasonal behaviors which are highly dependent on extensive ice shelves. Will they perish? In actuality, probably not. Animals are not just stupid. As changes occur to their traditional ways, animals will tend to adapt, to move, to find new sources of food. Will some be stranded and die? Sure. But others will find their way to new food sources. Will polar bears become extinct as a result? Very likely not, particularly if there is a concerted human effort to assist the animals. Polar bears actually live in small communities which have traditionally had to adapt to changing populations of prey species. So by helping individuals and small communities of animals, will actually help keep the entire species alive. All in all, global warming has a long way to go before it becomes life-threatening or a global disaster. And unless we are all virtually retarded, we will make appropriate changes to deal with these changes through time. It might be smart for us to plan to move as appropriate. After all, most of us have moved many times in our lifetimes, and in many cases it was a matter of choice. And to be honest, more people are moving to warmer climates than the other way around. So the Wild Side News thinks we do not need to get bent out of shape and predict death and destruction due to global warming. Time will tell. Story 2. Opponents of oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge are planning to introduce legislation which would permanently ban such by setting aside 1.2 million acres along the coastal strip as a permanent wilderness. After more than six successful attempts by the House of Representatives to authorize oil and gas drilling, this was countered by defeats each time in the Senate. This hotly contested issue just may find the support it needs to once and for all, or so one might hope anyway, give this area back to its native inhabitants, especially the caribou and elk, not to mention hundreds of species which rely on this habitat for their survival. Wildside News Projections. ANWR will not become a wilderness area in 2007, and likely not in 2008, as such designation requires a vote of 60 in the Senate to succeed, and those votes are not there yet. However, efforts to continue to introduce pro-drilling legislation will cease for a while, as the current administration begins to be scrutinized in both the House and the Senate, and will find itself increasingly having to focus on maintaining its power in light of increasing revelations of less than acceptable policies and practices. With each passing year, renewable technologies, which will include solar, biofuels, and wind, will be partnering with new transportation and energy technological breakthroughs, such as very functional and increasingly affordable electric cars, and a revolutionary integration of breakthroughs and inventions to create a national will to move in that direction, and thereby fizzle away this historic claim that the oil under ANWR is critical to our economic well-being and our vital national security. A new energy age is destined to change our future. Story 3. President Bush on Tuesday lifted the drilling ban for Alaska's Bristol Bay, thereby opening up the possibility for oil and gas development in this fish-rich area. Pressures by Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, a man who cannot imagine that there is any place on Earth that would not benefit from more oil and gas wells, managed to get a 16-year ban on fishing in Bristol Bay lifted as one of the last acts of the 2006 Congress. Newly appointed Interior Secretary Kemp Thorne has acknowledged that, yes, there likely will be oil and gas leases given out. The Wildside News Projections. The new battle that will be emerging within the next 5 years will have to do with fishing in all of its myriad manifestations, which will dredge up some muck about bottom dredging, large-scale floating fishing factories, and in particular, whaling. New pressures will be emerging from various large fishing players, particularly China, which relies heavily on fish for its protein. As projections of the ultimate collapse of the oceans somewhere between 2040 and 2050 emerge, China will likely become a worldwide leader in helping to establish large fish sanctuaries, as that is the only viable solution to restore fish supplies and maintain a viable supply of fish to its people. However, the efforts to restore the oceans will emerge as perhaps the singular most significant worldwide conservation effort within the next 20 years. Along with that will come a global awareness that maintaining diversity of as many species as possible is the most realistic and worthwhile solution to general sustainability of life on this earth. Will such a crusade succeed? It really depends on the crusaders themselves, which should include all people on earth. And story 4. Oil exploration in the Congo Republic by the French company Morel and Prom, within the confines of the world's most diverse ecological zone, is getting a lot of people very upset, as it is in direct violation of protections set up to protect some of the world's most advanced creatures, including mandrills, gorillas, and chimpanzees. Relying on massive seismic explosions to chart the underground supplies of oil, the company makes claims that because these are conducted completely underground, they cannot harm the animals. And of course, new roads, tracks, and bridges accompany the exploration, which is creating easy access by poachers and resulting in a direct increase in killings of the park's native species. Bottom line, Morel and Prom are making the most of their access with accompanying denials of the direct secondary and tertiary effects on the wildlife of the park. Wildside News projections. Besides amphibians and fish, both of which have reached a momentum of decline that may just plain be unstoppable, the plight of the wild primates is possibly only years away from being catastrophic. These large mammals have relied on vast stretches of forests and jungles and the ability to roam and intermix with a large population of their kind to maintain their highly complex social and behavioral integrity. As their homelands have been decimated by commercial deforestation, the penetration of their societies by humans, vehicles, roads, and poachers, hungry bushmeat eaters, trophy hunters, disease, Ebola-type pandemics, and more, they face the essential destruction of their life and spirit. And unless humanity responds immediately with every resource and goodwill available, we will likely see the global disappearance of these species in the wild. What is most alarming is that most of these changes have occurred during what I referred to earlier as the modern age. If we are maturing as a people here and around the world, here in 2007, and if we humans are the species that not only has the capacity to show real compassion, to the extent that we can talk about it, write about it, sing and build religious tenets about it, we should be compelled to make the immediate worldwide response to save these loving, caring, frightened, and dispirited beings, or we will have sold a portion of our cosmic souls to the dark forces that destroy the God-given wonder of such sentient and soul-filled creatures. In our history as the human species, the intelligent being, this just may be the most hideous act of arrogance that God will ever record. And that's the news. So it's just possible we are growing up. All we baby boomers who set out to change the world are now perhaps facing the truth that we now have to fix it. Just like us, this world is a bit out of shape. Time to exercise what wisdom we have left. So when we return, we take a reading break when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wildside News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
I'm sure that we've all experienced that unique thing that happens when we sit down to write something, a letter to a congressman, a short story, for some a novel, that moment when words actually begin to be put down. It seems a new channel of thought opens up that has wisdom and ways of expression we don't have when we just talk about things. So we're going to take a break and then do a reading from a new writer. So just stay tuned. In the weeks and months ahead, I'm going to be doing a series of readings. I think it'd be fun, primarily by current living writers about nature and the environment. Whether they're published or not doesn't really matter. What I'm looking for is great content, great written word, from people who capture their thoughts and ideas while way off in the back country or living an urban existence with thoughts of the wild or flying into the middle of a harp seal slaughter and putting their lives between club and cub. There's a special message that flows from the written word, and it's important that it be heard. So, do keep in mind that following the reading, I'll be telling you how you can get your writings featured on the Wild Side News. So, today I'm going to be reading a segment from a book by Susan Chernak McElroy, entitled All My Relations, and published by New World Library. So please enjoy River Elk. It was to be the most glorious of summers. All my prayers for the right place, the right work, the right time converged the day I signed the lease for the river house. I had just sold my home, the home that had burned to cinders and that I had rebuilt over the course of a year. My divorce was finalized, my new book partly done. I had a new sweetheart, Fritz, and my passion for life was flowing like the snowmelt that had just begun running down the Tetons. The house itself was modest, a 50s vintage cabin with little character that had seen better years. I referred to it as cozy, but in truth, it was tiny and cramped, with bedrooms that must have been designed before the creation of queen-sized beds. The back porch had partially caved in. The kitchen stove was home to several generations of mice, and the gravel driveway was a maze of teeth-rattling potholes and ruts that turned into lakes and rivers after a moderate rain. But the front window faced the Grand Tetons, and the kitchen and back looked out over a meandering trout stream that flowed between high cottonwoods and willows. Between the cabin and the mountains was nothing but the Snake River, flowing in undulating channels and carving out an ancient strand of river bottom. The setting was as close to paradise on earth as anything I have ever seen before or since. That the cabin was there at all, and that it was available to us, was a miracle. I imagine you could count the small, history-laden cabins that remained along the Snake River in Jackson Hole on one hand. Our neighbors were all millionaires and billionaires, their houses not houses at all, but huge estates with grand names and entry gates made of massive logs, iron or stone. We never met any of them. Next door to us, an 8,500-square-foot log and rock estate with its own man-made stream that you actually could switch on and off was under construction. The builders of this estate property controlled the general lease on our tiny cabin, which sat just out of sight behind a stand of spruce and cottonwoods, and they were wanting to rent it out for at least 6 months. I signed the lease papers on the 1st of April, near giddy with joy, and the very next day we began moving boxes into the place we christened the River House. The porches were still sagging under the weight of old winter snow, and the trees around the place were ashen-colored and bare. The Snake River out our front door was at low trickle, receiving just a fraction of the snowmelt that would be in full cascade by May. Through the gray and spindly mishmash of cottonwood twigs and willow bushes, our other new neighbors slipped past us in full and stunning view as we unpacked box after box eagles, owls, deer and elk, moose, two brown bears, muskrats and beavers, porcupines, coyotes, delicate-legged cranes, geese by the hundreds, and endless flocks of returning songbirds. I filled up a half dozen bird feeders twice a day to keep up with the throngs of chickadees and grosbeaks, nuthatches and flickers, hummingbirds and titmice. A family of seven baby chipmunks moved into the woodpile just outside our back door and stuffed the pockets of their cheeks with sunflower seeds scattered by the birds. God was blessing me, I told myself, for all the hard inner work I had done reconciling myself to the house fire of the previous year. How generous all the spirits were to bring me to this magnificent place in which to complete my book and begin my new life with my new love. I moved to the cabin, humble and grateful, knowing that it was a sign of affirmation that I had done a good job and was on Creator's spiritual A-list. For the rest of the summer, it just got better. The trees budded, and goslings and otters floated by on the swollen river, which called to us day and night with a voice like strong, fresh wind. Cranes did their mating dances, wings outstretched and toes pointed, leaping into the blue mountain air. A baby boot-nosed bull moose nibbled on willow branches outside my office window, so close I could hear the leaves being pulled from the stems while I wrote at my small desk for hours and days that seemed endless, timeless. The feathers that came to me on my river walks each day with the dogs were tantalizing. I found the fluffy breast feathers of ravens and owls, the tail feather of a bald eagle, the crisp wing feathers of geese and hawks and ducks. Our front porch became a tangle of driftwood and old bones. For each of the gifts I brought home from the abundant river, I gave thanks and left a gift in return, strands of my hair, a flower, a spontaneous song, a prayer. And then on the 23rd of August, on a warm night that held just the tiniest hint of fall, my grand and affirmative summer became completely perfect. In the still of the late night, under a canopy of summer stars, a bull elk trumpeted outside our bedroom window. His voice started low in the chest, rumbling up his neck in a hollow bellow that morphed into a high and breathy flute whistle as it left his lips. The sound of the rut, the seeding of new life, is a sound I seek out every fall, but this was the first time the sound ever came to find me. Always before, it had been me stealing quietly into the forest in hopes of finding the bulls, listening on the edge of night meadows for the sound that brings shivers up my spine and into my face and squeezes hot tears out of my eyes. This night, the elk came to me, singing a circle around the river house, bellowing his love song until the black sky blended into dawn pearl. For all the symphony of sounds I had heard that summer, nothing touched the magic of his music. As the night sky faded, I heard his hoofs crunch in the dry cottonwood leaves and fade into the morning toward the river. In the ensuing moments of pre-dawn silence, I imagined he had come to me as a culmination of all the signs of affirmation I had received that summer. All were gathered to him, held by him, wrapped in the gift wrap of his voice and tied in ribbons of his presence. When he returned near dawn the next day to serenade me again, I bolted from my bed to catch a glimpse of him. In the gray light, I saw him walking away from me, once more toward the river. His crown of antlers was fat as my arm at the base, held high on a neck thick and dark as a tree trunk, and no doubt as strong. He stepped high and deliberately, and his outstretched nose was humped and broad. How beautifully, how perfectly he suited his voice. In the weeks to come, two more bull elk came to the river, one with a lyrical call of all flute notes and no chest bellows, and one a square-bodied, stout fellow whose call was always discordant and off-key. In the night, we would hear the trio of bulls dueling for the herds of cow elk that were gathering all around us. At first, the bugles would sound far from one another, then closer as the bulls marched forward to fight for the right to claim the cows. On still nights, when the air carried the sound from the river up to the sky, we would hear the clack of their antlers crashing against one another, the sound of bone to bone. During the daylight hours, mostly in the morning and at twilight, we would sometimes catch precious glimpses of the elk, both cows and bulls hurrying along the dry river channels, anxious and excited with the energy of rut and breeding. Soon we realized that the off-key bull and the lyrical fluting bull had lost the battle for the cows. The harems were in the custody of our bull, the deep-voiced, massive-crowned singer. It could be no other way. The fluting bull was smaller, younger. The off-key bull lacked that throaty resonance that signifies a huge-necked, mature, confident bull elk. The cows had chosen well. On an evening walk I will never forget, we turned a bend on the river bank and caught a view that lodged my breath in my heart. It was September, twilight hushing the sounds of the day. In front of my eyes, a peninsula of sand and grasses jutted out into the season-spent river. Gathered on that white sand, standing quietly among clumps of green bushes and yellow grass, 24 cow elk grazed under a sinking sun that splashed golden light across their backs. Between us and the cows marched the bull, our bull, strutting back and forth, nodding his antlers from side to side, stretching out his neck and face to shoulder level, and bellowing his song. His back, too, was lit with the golden light that poured from the autumn sky like honey. The whole world before me seemed to be wrapped in a circle of precious amber, and peace rose up from my heart and lodged in my throat. I wished instantly and fervently for that sight to never leave me, and it never has. I wrapped my arms around Fritz and sighed into his chest that life could get no better than this. The next day, as though in direct response to my claim of perfection, our landlord called to deliver the news. The big estate next door was completed and sold, and the new owner had other plans for our little cabin. We had 30 days to move. 30 days to pack up, to find a place that would rent to us with 2 dogs and a cat, and to put the river house behind us. Both of us were struck speechless and dumb. Normally, I go into high gear at times like this. My middle name is Can Do. But this time, I collapsed inside and out and could do nothing. My feet felt weighted with river rocks, and I walked through the next week of shining autumn glory as though I were wading through mud. Fritz collected boxes, but I could not fill them. I could not lift up my hands in any effort that would take me away from my home on the river. They hung in clenched, hopeless fists from my arms and would not serve me. At night, while I huddled under my covers, exhausted, miserable, and sick, the river elk, our elk, would call hauntingly from the woods by the water, and I would weep and wonder how I could possibly leave him. On Sunday morning, 2 weeks after our landlord had told us we needed to move on, Fritz and I finished up an early oatmeal breakfast and headed out from the front door on a straight line toward the river. The air was clear and citrus-flavored, and the dogs were leaping like gazelles. I was in a bubble of misery that even the river could not burst. And so I did not notice at first that the cottonwood tree in front of me was draped with 100 ravens. I did not notice the magpies whirling over me or my dogs as they shifted from dancing to stillness. These things pierced me only when Fritz said, "Can you smell it? Can you smell it?" Like a waft of black smoke, the scent enveloped us, thick, sweet, rank. Real time became dream time, and we moved forward silently, like puppets on God's strings, pulled against our wills to the edge of a sandy bank that dropped off to the river bottom. Above us, the ravens hunched silent and wary. Below us, just over the edge of the low bank, lay a tangle of massive branches. No, not branches. Oh, God. Antlers. sprawled in front of us, his neck twisted harshly, his huge rack of horns impaled point first into the dirt, lay the river elk, dead. The four of us froze in silence. In slow motion, the dogs approached him, crouching and extending their noses to touch his golden back. Arrow whined and licked him softly. I slid down the bank and dropped to my knees beside him and extended my hands, my leaden hands that had stopped serving me, to touch his neck. It was still warm. Sounds fell from our mouths as Fritz placed his hands on the white tips of the elk's antlers, but no words came to us. In those first moments of shock and denial, all we could do was murmur, sigh, gasp, and moan. When we could finally speak, we told ourselves that he must have been fatally gored in a battle with one of the other bulls. We touched him everywhere, from his glassy, dull eyes to the curve of his sable-colored thigh. There was not a mark on him. He was sleek, fat, shiny, massive. Urine soaked his saggy mane, and I felt its stickiness on my hands. That rancid anointment had been a signal of his pride and his power, the cologne of the breeding bull, the intoxication of his cows. The birds loomed above us, impatient and suspicious. Now my legs and hands moved freely. My mind cleared. What to do? First pray, then open him up for the birds. Fritz headed back to the cabin to fetch an axe and my ceremonial pipe and some sage. I sat in tears, rocking and stroking the velvet nose of this one whose voice had carried me on a magic carpet of sound through the most picture-perfect summer in my life. I could not leave him, I told myself, and so he had left me. His body was bent in a wrenched and awkward pose. It looked as though he had fallen off the shallow embankment head first and never moved again. Instinct commanded my hands, as it had years before, when I prepared and tended the body of my father for the coming of the hearse. I grabbed the bull's feet and tugged, trying to roll him onto his side so that I could ease his antlers from the dirt and lay him out in a figure of repose. His deadness resisted me, hundreds of pounds of non-responsive flesh and bone, but gravity was on my side. He finally turned and settled so that his neck and his trunk were facing the same way. That was when I found the small, bloodless hole up near his back. Why I did what I did next, I do not know. My hands reached for the wound and then into it, fingers coming up into his body, while my mind said, "How deep? How deep does a gore wound go?" I felt the splinter of a bone against my hand and automatically wrapped my fingers around it and pulled. My hand rose up in front of my face, holding not a bone, but the broken shaft and razored point of a metal arrow. Blood dripped from its hollow core. My eyes widened in horror. It was not the world that had taken him away from me, but a poacher on these private lands. Someone had watched for this bull, for these antlers, for this head. I shivered and looked into the trees around us. Surely, surely he was there. Surely he had stalked our elk as he stumbled his way through the trees to collapse and die directly in front of our cabin. I looked at Strongheart lying quietly, watchfully, a few feet away. My devoted and fearless guardian, Strongheart, would defend me and defend this spot against anyone. I would not give up the river elk. When Fritz returned, we smudged the body of the elk with sage and tied prayer ties to his ankles. We gathered dried flowers and foxtails into a bundle. I loaded and offered my pipe, sending prayers for the river elk's soul journey and gratitude for his voice and his magic. With axe and butcher knife, we split open his hide so that the birds could carry his spirit with them. And then, in the end, we severed his head, that prized and regal head that had cost him his life, and dragged it back to the cabin with us. That afternoon, with Strongheart in tow. I hurried back once more to the elk's body, carrying an old elk skull I had found along the river. I placed it at the elk's neck, and then stepped back, taking a long, cleansing breath. The river elk lay with his skull head grinning, his feet sprouting the colors of the prayer wrappings, a bouquet of dying wild flowers and grasses over his heart. He was a spirit being now, and I stood still in wonderment at the look of him. It was not yet time to leave. I sat down near the bank and asked myself questions, deluding myself into thinking I knew the answers. My first question was, why? Several answers came to me. He did this for me. I'm not good enough. It's a sign. God has dropped you from her A-list. I have failed the test of this summer. Then, what was the test? Something is over. A new beginning is coming. Have you not felt it in the cold night winds of these weeks? You and your new love are crumbling, and your partnership will not last. Because I did not know what else to do, I rose to leave. Take me with you, I heard. I looked at the elk. I did take you with me, I told him. Your head is in my car. I'll clean it down to bone and keep it safe always. I'll honor your spirit. Take me with you. My body jolted up in sudden recognition. I knew exactly what I was being asked to do. Communion. I don't know if I can do this. I'll be sick. In slow motion, my hands sweating cold, I crouched down by the river elk's gaping neck wound and tore off a small chunk of meat. Gagging, I put it in my mouth and swallowed hard. It tasted horrid, metallic, gritty, greasy. My throat muscles constricted around the flesh and tried to send it back up. I swallowed again, gagged again, and then it was done. Calling Strongheart to me, I turned away from the elk and hurried back to the cabin. It was finished. The summer, the elk, all of it. That night, my no longer uncooperative hands wrapped themselves around me like a comforting shawl. And in the morning, I began to pack. I've been reading from a segment from a book by Susan Chernak McElroy and published by New World Library. It was called River Elk. Now, if you're a writer, published or otherwise, and would like to have your writings featured on the Wild Side News, I'm looking for a message from you. Here's what you can do. Send me an email. Send it to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. With information about you, about your piece, include your name, email, and whatever you wish to share about yourself. Now, my preference is that you attach the writings as a Word document to your email. Or, of course, you can just embed it in the text of the email, but I'd prefer an attachment. Please include a sentence stating that you authorize me to read this on the show, and I'll confirm with you if your piece is selected to be read on air so that you can make the most of it. You can enjoy it yourself, and you can let all your friends know that your writings are being featured here on the Wild Side News. So I want to say thanks. I'm looking forward to this new feature. And now, in just a moment, we'll continue with some great new outdoor ideas that you just may find interesting when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
The river's on the rise, swift and gentle like the breeze. Swallows everything but sky. It suffocates the trees. Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? If I sink or swim.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As 2007 dawns, it's time to have more fun, and getting out and around needs to be scribbled onto more of our calendars this year. So to help you find an even easier excuse to get out more, you're going to hear about some great new products that I learned about at the nation's premier outdoor retailers show held in Salt Lake City each year. So we start out by putting me on the hot seat. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News. If you ever have the chance to visit the Outdoor Retailer Show, which is held in Salt Lake each year, grab it. You'll see more great new products and gear from the world's leading outdoor and recreational manufacturers. You're about to hear about three great new products. We start out, as I end up, on the hot seat. Well, now, actually, I'm looking at John Schenck of MNJ Bottom Line from Seattle, Washington, who has a new product he calls the Amazing New Hot Seat, and he encouraged me to sit on it. What is supposed to happen when I sit on this?
It's supposed to get warm and fuzzy instantly, and it'll last for 7 hours.
Well, let me give this a try. I'm looking at a little chair, and these are about 16 inches square. Am I close? 16?
16 by 15 by 2 inches.
See? Real good. And it says the hot seat, and I'm going to sit down on this thing. It's just like a little cushion, 2 inches. And let's see what happens. Oh, my God, that feels great. That's phenomenal.
They are fully portable, fully rechargeable, can go anywhere, waterproof, and it's good for camping, hunting, fishing, outdoor stadiums, mom's soccer games, you name it.
What happened was I sat on it within about 5 seconds. Suddenly, my butt felt very warm and comfortably warm.
It certainly is. We have had a lot of wonderful feedback on these, mainly from the female side, and usually they feel like they need to run to the restroom real quickly.
I'm a little confused. Why is this rechargeable?
It's rechargeable because there's only two other products that claim to do this. One, you throw in the microwave, which then you have to throw in the trunk of your car and hope it's still warm by the time you get there. The other one is a chemical reaction, which at the end of the heating process, you throw away. Ours is completely rechargeable, reusable, good for 700 uses. If you simply connect the seat with the two connectors, it will start heating. At the end of 5 to 7 hours and 115 degrees, you simply charge it up overnight like you do your cell phone, and you're good to go again the next day.
That effect will last for 7 hours then?
The heating effect lasts 7 hours. Just like your talking effect on your cell phone will last you about 5 to 7 hours. The heating effect lasts the same time. Charge it up overnight. Good to go again the next day.
Okay, I'm going to try this on Claire, my associate producer. Claire, sit down. We're going to get a live reaction here. Okay, she's sitting on a blue seat.
Ooh, very nice. Very comfy.
What are you experiencing?
Great warmth, and I could see where this would help a lot looking at baseball games and football games and stuff like that. Yes.
Fishing, camping, right? That type of thing?
Fishing, camping, hunting, boating. Yeah. Those cold steel bleachers, no more.
Very cool product. And so if people wanted to find out more about this, where would they go?
They can check us out on our website at www.thehotseat.biz, B-I-Z, or you can call us in Seattle at M&J Bottom Line.
What's that number?
206-915-7837.
Now, if I was really anxious to get one of these, what would I expect to pay?
It retails for $69.99, and they're guaranteed for life. If it ever fails to heat or hold a charge, we'll replace it at no cost.
Then these are reaching out into retailers around the country?
That's what we're doing here at the Outdoor Retailer Show. We're talking with a couple of the shopping networks. We'll have an infomercial coming out in October in the northeastern part of the country.
I was going to say it's a very cool product, and it is, except that it's a very warm product.
It's a very hot product.
Bingo.
Thank you.
I'm sitting here talking with Braden Bailey of Hamaca. Is that correct?
We pronounce it two different ways. Hamaca is how we say it, but we go by Hamaca just as well. So,
well, Hamaca sounds like a hammock. Am I anywhere close to what this is about?
That is exactly what it's about. We specialize in two hammocks. We have a hammock chair and also a little parachute silk hammock that's kind of a little light-breathing, portable hammock that you can bring with you and store just any two trees you can find up in the mountains and sit and relax in it just like a hammock. And then our hammock chair is kind of a patio piece of furniture, or you can take camping with you. It comes with a carrying case, but it hangs from a single point, so it's a little easier to hang than a hammock. Just need a branch or any single point you can find, but it gives you the same feeling, relaxation, like a hammock. It takes away the pressure points on your body just the same.
This is one of those chairs you've seen around all over the place, particularly, as you say, on patios and places like that and porches, and it basically hangs from one point, just like you said, and most people are actually fairly familiar with them. And if you were to take this outdoors, then what do you look at in terms of weight and size and portability?
The chair can hold 350 pounds, and we have stands likewise that can hold 350 pounds, so you're limited up to 350 pounds depending on your branch and where you can find to hang it from, or your balcony. Chair's capable of holding 350 pounds.
Now, if people want to learn more about the Hamaca, where would they go?
Do you know what? We can either call us toll-free at 877-HAMACA, which is spelled H-A-M-M-A-K-A, or you can visit us at www.hamaca.com, again, H-A-M-M-A-K-A.
And what sort of price range are people looking at on these?
We sell ours for $79.99 retail, and our hammocks sell for $4.95 retail as well. Comes with a carrying case, a cup holder, foot rest, inflatable pillow, and the hardware to be able to hang it into your ceiling joist or off the balcony. We also offer two different metal stands with it. One's a tripod stand that weighs 9.5 pounds, made to take to the beach or camping. That one will sell for $129.99. And then we have our big C stand, which is more for the patio. Looks like a big C. It's a big metal stand. Weighs about 70 pounds, so it's a little bit heavier, something you wouldn't want to bring around with you. But it sells for $159.99.
Terrific. Okay, Braden Bailey, thanks for talking to us on the Wild Side News.
Thanks, Sydney.
Sitting to my left here is Hank Birnbaum, and he's the president of High Sierra. Hank, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Glad to be here.
First of all, let our listeners know, who may not know about High Sierra, what the nature of your business is.
High Sierra, really today, is a company that specializes in adventure travel gear, backpacks for both camping, traveling, and back to school. The adventure travel category really is something that's grown a lot in the outdoor industry because a lot of the people that are enjoying the outdoors don't see themselves traveling with conventional suitcases. We've done a lot of products of that type.
That's one of the hottest new items, I think, out there right now, is for people who haven't seen this, although I would guess most people have somewhere in an airport. You certainly see them all the time. And this is basically, it's a convertible suitcase that you can use as a backpack, but as well take right out into the forest and the woods and do what you do.
That's right. And some products lend themselves more to that application than others. But it's interesting, in speaking with some consumers as well as some dealers, you know, we've asked people to define the buzzword of adventure travel, and oftentimes people are thinking of the whole concept of adventure, and they think it's something rather dangerous. You fall, you die. But really, that isn't the case. Adventure travel, I like to create the parallel to today's SUV. We all grew up carpooling with our parents, and the family station wagon is what you went to the grocery store, the family vacation, and was then the soccer mom vehicle. And today we're all using SUVs, and if you try and think about what the real difference is between those two types of vehicles, a lot of it's mental, but the other is the SUV is much more versatile and does just everything better. Today's adventure travel luggage and travel gear is that same comparison to a conventional suitcase. You can carry it on your back when you have other things to do with your hands. You can go upstairs if there's any kind of snowbanks or construction or puddles or whatever. It gives you the ability to move it from point A to point B much more, with more versatility.
Now, talk about the construction of these, because I'm sure you're using some great new technologies in terms of construction and materials.
One of the buzzwords beyond just the versatility in today's travel gear products is lightweight. I think this really came about when the airlines started to enforce 50-pound limits on what you could check in as checkable luggage. And so the consumer became very sensitive to the fact that if all they could do is check in a bag that was weighing 50 pounds, the bag that they started with needed to be lighter to allow them to put more of their personal belongings in. So our company, as well as others, we've really examined carefully how to keep the integrity of the product, make sure it stands up properly, doesn't fall over when you pack it, make sure that the baggage handlers aren't going to destroy it, but at the same time, look for techniques to reduce weight. And one of the things that has happened is we're using more modern-day materials, and we're using a lot of molded components where before maybe earlier versions of this type of product might have had plywood boards and lots of rivets. And so there's all types of techniques that are being used.
Now, of course, this is radio, so you're describing all these wonderful things. I'm looking at the catalog here, and I'm going to say that when I look at the products here, they're beautifully designed. They're like little works of art. It's something you can be proud to wear. It doesn't look like standard sort of outdoor gear. Lots of beautiful colors, but also just interesting design. And I think it's cool stuff. But for people who want to really see some of the gear, let's talk about your website and how they can easily find out about your product line.
Well, you can go on our website, which is always being updated, in that we introduce new products regularly. As the products get into the consumer channels, we'll update the website with all of our latest offerings. Our website is www.highsierrasport.com. Probably an easier way that I can tell people about, it's the acronym, it's www.hssc.com, and that'll get you there, and then you can browse by a particular type of bag or by a collection of bag, and you'll find our products.
Well, I certainly encourage listeners to do that, but here's what I want you to try to define, because as I look through your catalog, let's talk about some of the smallest items, and it's a whole arena to some very serious travel gear. So give us an idea of that spectrum. I think that would be fun.
In the smaller products that we offer today, I think one of the most popular categories addresses hydration. We have a collection of hydration backpacks and hydration lumbar packs that either use thermal polyurethane, a TPU reservoir, and then the hose and the mouthpiece. And we've just here at this show started introducing a product that uses GE Lexan polycarbonate bottles that you would wear on your lumbar pack. And a lot of really good-looking stuff, very ergonomic, really comfortable to wear, using modern materials, wicking air mesh so that if you have something on your back or your waist, it's absorbing the moisture and then dispersing it so you don't feel hot and sweaty. So there's lots of neat products there on the smaller size of things. And then, as you pointed out, you get up into the much larger items, and we do travel packs and we do actual climbing packs. We've got some really innovative travel duffels. One of the things that's going on in the duffel world today, people have these wheeled duffels, and a duffel bag's always been a horizontal product, but people today want to be able to stand them up when they're not wheeling them. Rather than laying them down on the ground, you want to just be able to stand them up like you would a suitcase. So what we're finding is there's sort of a hybrid direction that's taking place with the cargo bag or the duffel bag, to where it's being used in a much more vertical design.
Yeah. Now I noticed that you actually have some what I would call expedition gear. I mean, these are like trunks and suitcases,
right,
that are soft and transportable for the person who really wants to do some heavy packing.
Right. And I travel personally about 250 days a year or more, so I'm a pretty good guinea pig for what works and what doesn't work. And getting back to that idea of adventure travel, I talked about the versatility of getting from point A to point B, but the other side of adventure travel that addresses the versatility is how you organize all the different things that you want to take with you. So having compartments that allow you to put, say, for example, all your underwear in one compartment, your shoes in a different compartment, your toiletries still in another, we've made our adventure travel product so that you have the ability to compartmentalize things, and then if you would prefer to have one large cavity, the bags convert to give you one big open area as well.
What do you feel is your favorite new item?
If I were to pick something that would be a favorite, it would probably be our new lumbar hydration product. Mm-hmm. It's pretty exciting stuff. Mm-hmm. We've come out with some really great designs. And if I can pass on one idea to the consumer, when I started this company, it was with the idea that there were a lot of very expensive products on the market, and there were quite a few low-priced products that performed like low-priced products. I ended up going to the University of Colorado. I spent a lot of time in the mountains, and on a student's budget, I couldn't necessarily afford the most expensive high-end product out there. So our company started with the mission of giving consumer product with a tremendous amount of design and construction integrity, and that has never changed. Our product's meant to be used and enjoyed. It's functional, and yet it's more affordable than perhaps some of the alternatives that might be out there.
Go ahead,
there.
Talk about your pricing. What kind of person expect in, let's say, a transportable backpack unit?
Well, we have a really great carry-on friendly transportable backpack with a removable front day pack, and I would say that typically it's being sold for about $100.
You're kidding.
And it competes nicely with products that sell for double that amount.
That's a fabulous price.
Yeah, and the product's meant to be used. It really performs great, and if you were to see some of the consumer feedback that we get, and we get it off a lot of our customers' websites, invariably consumers say, this is a great product, I would recommend it to anybody, I'm very happy with it, it does exactly what I wanted it to do.
And people who want to find your products, where do they go?
Certainly on the web, one of our more prolific retailers would be eBags, www.ebags.com. And in terms of traditional retail, we're sold in Better Sporting Goods stores. Most frontline department stores and luggage stores will sell our product as well.
Well, Hank, I want to thank you for being on the Wild Side News. It's been a real pleasure talking with you, and I wish you great success with your High Sierra product line.
Thanks a lot.
Next week, you'll have the chance to hear about some revolutionary ideas about how to really reshape our future as we hear about Lester Brown's revolutionary Model B2. And we talk with one of the world's leading outdoor photographers and find out what keeps him snapping. So until then, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again, or any time in the archives, when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.